Let's get started in our second presentation on introduction to stocks. And in this presentation, we'll discuss some of the characteristics of different transactions and then take a deep look at the indices, the indexes, the averages that we hear about every day, and not many people really know what they are. So let's get started on slide 34. Bull market, bear market. Have you heard the terms? Bull markets are favorable markets normally associated with rising prices, investor optimism, economic recovery, and government stimulus. Whereas bear markets are unfavorable markets normally associated with falling prices, investor pessimism, economic slowdown, or government restraint. Where do the terms come from? Bull markets. Well, bulls supposedly, this is the story everyone tells. I don't know if it's true, but this is what they say. Bulls charge ahead. They throw their opponents up in the air, whereas bears are very reclusive, and they, when they do attack, they knock their opponents down with their claws. Supposedly, it came from a saying that's very old, when there were what are called bearskin jobbers, people whose job it was to go out and kill the bear and bring back the bearskin, and they said, don't sell the bearskin before the bear is caught. I don't know how that turned into a bear market, but a bear market is generally considered 20% down from the peak or more. If it only goes down 5, 10, 15%, that's a correction. You need to know these two terms. Slide number 35, transactions. By far the most popular and the one I suggest that you use is a market order. I want to buy 100 shares of a company. I want to sell 100 shares of a company. Give me the best price right now. I'll sell the darn thing. But you can set what's called a limit order, which says, yeah, I'll buy it, but only if it goes down to this price. Or I'll sell it, but only if it goes up to this price. So I am setting a price that I specify. Now, I may never reach that, but that's the idea. Now, what's the stop loss order, stop limit order? Well, these are triggered by certain points that the price makes. A stop loss order, will execute once the price hits a point that you specified. So many people call it a stop loss because, hey, I've made some money on this stock. It's selling for 25 bucks. If it ever goes below 22, Mr. Broker, Mr. Computer System, because it's all done computerized, I want you to sell it. But the stop loss is different than the stop limit. And how is that? Well, the stop loss says, I don't care what price you get me. If it touches that price point, get out. Sell it. Or buy it if you're going the other way. The stop limit says, yes, I want you to put in an order, but I want you to put in a limit order, not a market order, but a limit order. Once the trigger point is reached, I will only sell or buy at the price that I specify. So a stop loss order, once the trigger point is reached, becomes a market order. The stop limit order, once the trigger is reached, becomes a limit order. Although you can use limit orders to buy and sell at the price you want, and stop loss and stop limit orders to lock in profits or protect against losses, remember that they trigger automatically. If for some reason you change your mind, it's usually too late to cancel the order. You got to run to the terminal. Too late. It's already happened. These transactions happen very quickly now with the Kaspida computers. Slide 36 is a table from your book that tries to show you the subtleties between the stop order and the stop limit order. So they're a little bit similar, but what you have to remember is the market order buys or sells at whatever price is out there. Right now, it's going to happen. The limit order is going to buy or sell at a price that you set, and it may never reach that price. The stop order will hit when will hit a certain breakpoint, and then it'll become a market order. The stop limit order, it'll hit a certain breakpoint, and then it'll become a limit order. I normally recommend market orders. You want to buy, you want to sell. But short-term traders, speculators tell me they prefer limit orders or stop orders on all of their trades, right? Because they're in it for the short term. So this is covered in detail in chapter 2. I don't want you to, you can read chapter 2 if you want in the book, but it goes into far too much detail because they want you to be buying and selling throughout the semester, something I don't want you to do, but it's up to you. Slide 37, buying on margin and selling short. Well, we're going to just introduce these ideas, but all you have to know is what's on this slide, okay? Because we're going to deal with these in detail much later. In fact, at the end of the semester. Why? Because they are important, but they're also tricky. They're very tricky, and they're not necessarily the best thing for you to do, in my humble opinion. Buying on margin is borrowing money from your broker to enhance your return. What? Well, you know, if you had $100, you could buy a share for $100. But what if you only have $50? You can go to your broker and say, Mr. Broker, Ms. Broker, my credit is good. I'd like to buy that share for $100, but I only have $50. And the broker says, no problem. We'll lend you the money. You've got to pay interest. All right. And then selling short is borrowing stock and selling it in the hopes that the price will go down. You can make money when the price goes down? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Remember buy low, sell high? Well, it doesn't matter what order you do it in. Most people try to buy low and sell high. But you can also sell high and then buy low. What? You sell stock that you do not own? Yeah. But then you got to buy it back, folks. You can't just sell something you don't own. You have to buy it back. You have to buy it back. You're borrowing the stock, and then you're turning around and buying it back. Okay. It doesn't sound legal, does it? Right. That's the first reaction that most people get when they hear about selling short. The book spends way too much time discussing margin accounts, selling short in Chapter 2. As I said, we'll discuss these in detail late in the semester. My advice to you is never sell short. Peter Lynch says you should never sell short, and who am I to argue with him? It's just way too risky, folks. You can lose a lot of money very quickly. Using a margin account can be useful once you've built up a substantial portfolio. It allows you to borrow from your portfolio without having to sell your stock. So you can think of it like the home equity line of credit for your house. But again, all you have to know is buying on margin is borrowing money to enhance your returns. Selling short is borrowing stock and hoping it goes down. That's it. That's all you have to know for now. Later on, we'll go into the details, which are kind of tricky. Slide 38, transaction costs. Transaction costs typically were in the 1 to 5% range, sometimes higher, and the largest percentage of the cost was the broker's commission, traditionally. But that's not true anymore. Deep discount internet brokers have driven the commissions down to as low as $5 a trade. A few firms used to offer free trades. Wait a minute. How do they make any money with a free trade? Have transaction costs really gone down? Well, the truth is they have. But what's happening is more and more of the cost is hidden from the investor. And especially the internet garbage brokers. Now, folks, those aren't my words. I didn't coin that. I was discussing with a few other people, very sophisticated investors, and this was quite some time ago. And I was really kind of confused, and I was trying to think, how are these people making, if I saw our cost at the brokerage firm I worked for, how are these people making any money? And they just looked at me like, you rube, you dummy, and then they started explaining how the internet garbage brokers make money. Slide number 39. For example, a deep discount internet broker, which shall remain nameless, Scottrade, offers trades for $7. And by the way, I'm not just picking on Scottrade. They all do it, but I'm using them as an example. In the fine print of the client broker agreement is included a provision for allowing the broker to solely utilize exclusive stock dealers and market makers. What we need to remember is that the quoted price that we are shown is simply the best price available. But at any one time, there are dozens of prices quoted as dealers and market makers compete for buy and sell orders. You're going to take a look at the Casas de Cambio presentation, where at any given time, there are lots of different people offering you different prices for pesos and dollars. And it's the same idea. And the chosen dealer doesn't necessarily have the best price. Mm-hmm. Instead of paying $20, the investor might pay $20.05. So the investor sees the $7 commission on their confirmation, but the investor does not see the extra, say, $5 they paid on a 100-share purchase because of the dealer's markup. See what's happening? You don't see that. Doesn't show up on your ticket, on your confirmation. And on slide 40, we see the following disclaimer, which I'm not sure if it still is, but this was included in each trade confirmation email from Scottrade. So let's try to read this, huh? Let's try to understand this. Scottrade Incorporated receives remuneration for directing orders to particular broker dealers or market centers for execution. Such remuneration is considered compensation to the firm, and the source and amount of any compensation received by the firm in connection with your transaction will be disclosed upon request. What? I know, it sounds like, that's why I sang it, because it sounds like something out of a Smells and Bells Latin Mass. What are they saying? Well, they're telling you, dear students, dear investors, that they're getting a kickback. Remuneration. Isn't that a great term? And they are directing their orders to certain particular broker-dealers, certain market centers, right? The market makers, we talked about the specialists. I got into the wrong mob. And that broker-dealer is giving back some of the markup to Scottrade. And in Scottrade's defense, folks, at least they prominently disclose this relationship on every trade confirmation email. But, of course, they put it in uppercase because they want it to look like they want you to read it, but they understand that people have a hard time reading all uppercase. That's why they put it all in uppercase, to make it look like it's important, but then nobody will read it. Many other brokers just hide it in their customer agreement fine print, and the customers are really never aware of the relationship. So, on slide 41, the Securities Exchange Commission, though, says that your broker has a duty to seek the best execution that is reasonably available for its customers' orders. But that's not a guarantee. The SEC requires brokers and dealers to notify their customers if their orders are not routed for best execution. Typically, this disclosure is on the trade confirmation slip or email you receive after placing your order. And determining whether or not a customer got best execution can be very difficult. And here's a link to a law professor's website where it's showing the SEC is trying to enforce the rules and not doing a very good job of it, it turns out. Exactly. So, what's going on here? Slide 42. The Securities Exchange Commission was looking into making the cost more transparent, possibly showing the customer the difference between the dealer's price and the best price available at the time of the transaction. Maybe even, gasp, showing the total cost of the transaction from the markup or the markdown. Needless to say, the deep discount brokers cried that it would drive up the cost of commissions and ultimately hurt the consumer. What? And the proposal died. So it is up to you, dear investor, to check if you're getting the best execution. So, but how can you, a lone investor, determine if you're getting the best price, even if the SEC has trouble watching over the brokerage companies? I got into the wrong mob. Well, what can I say? I know that the discount brokers normally will give you the best price. And, of course, the full-service brokers will do that, but you know they're charging you a whole lot more. So you'll probably wind up paying more even after the markup or down, markdown if you go with the discount brokers or the full-service brokers. When you're getting paying $5 a trade or whatever it is, you're probably getting hit with a few extra pennies per, you know, whatever. It's not going to be much, folks. And the one that I found seems to have the lowest prices, but doesn't on their commission, but does not get any kickback, is Schwab. Schwab is a traditionally the largest discount broker, but they have embraced the and technology, like as the you know the Scott Trades and the E-Trades of the world, and so check them out because as of my last checking, as I checked last time, they still did not do this markup markdown sharing. I hate to use the word kickback because it sounds so, you know, it doesn't sound good. But that's basically what they're doing. They're getting remuneration from the dealer, from the market maker, from the specialist. Slide 43. So what's a round lot? What's an odd lot? Well, a round lot is any transaction that involves 100 shares or multiples of 100 shares. Odd lot is a transaction that has less than 100 shares. And there was a very strong reason for brokers to suggest to their clients that they buy and sell in round lots. Because there was an extra cost called the odd lot differential that was imposed for you to buy in less than 100 share increments. And it used to be, believe it or not, 12.5 to 25 cents typically. Huh? 12.5 cents? Yeah, it's a long story, but it's ancient technology these days, folks. And it was because of the way that brokers traded on the floors. This is trivia because it's all gone, but if a broker yelled out 25 and pulled his hands toward him, what that broker was saying is, I will buy 100 shares at $25 a share. If he or she yelled out two at 25, I will buy and moved his hand towards himself. That meant he would buy or she would buy 200 shares, two lots, two round lots. If they pushed their hands away from themselves, they were signaling to the other brokers that they were looking to sell those round lots. But if that was a odd lot, if it wasn't an odd lot, they would have to say 27 shares at 25. So you see, it slowed things down. And so they charged you more. So still, to this day, some people recommend against odd lot purchases. But the differential is pennies now, if it's that much. So it might be a dollar, it might be a couple bucks at the most. And I don't really know because I'm not in the pits. I'm not in the pits anymore. They're not in the pits anymore. They're in front of a computer. I can't imagine that the differential now is more than a couple pennies at the most. So don't worry about it. Don't let anybody tell you you have to buy in 100 share increments. But as an introduction to investment students, you have to know what a round lot is, what an odd lot is. Slide 44, stock quotes. Well, you're going to do some research. You're going to take a look at some stock quotes. And at any source is going to have different things that they show off. Different sources will contain some or all of, or more of these statistics. But if you remember, the quoted prices are not the only prices available. At any given time, there are many prices available for many different dealers, many different market makers and specialists. The quoted prices are the best prices available. Plus, if you don't pay extra or go to your dealer's or go to your broker's office or have your broker on the phone, The price that you see on the internet is 15, 20 minutes ago. You don't see the current price. You have to pay extra for that. Or you talk to your broker because they have the current price as well, as best as they can do. And this is a graphic from your book for the Wall Street Journal, because it's practically the only newspaper that still publishes the prices. Oh my God, you mean you actually wait until the next day to find out how much your stock is worth? Oh, how 20th century. Yeah, all the other newspapers stopped publishing a long time ago because they knew everybody was going to the internet to find their quotes. And speaking of the internet, slide 46, where do you go? Well, I used to use almost exclusively finance.yahoo.com, quote.yahoo.com. And just recently, folks, they destroyed it. They really, I don't know what they were thinking. I think they've been taken over by somebody with a serious case of ADHD. I forget what it stands for. But somebody who can't have more than a 20 to 30 second attention span. And it's just horrible. But I still use it to research individual stocks, because they haven't destroyed that yet. It's only a matter of time that they do that. Some people tell me they like Bloomberg. I don't think it's that great. MarketWatch.com, which is owned by the Wall Street Journal, is not bad. It's not that great either. Morningstar, check them out. If you find one that you really, really like, please send it my way, because I'm looking for something better. I hope that they change back to Yahoo, because to back to what it was, because it's just horrible. It's just horrible. The one that's really interesting, you would think they would get into the fray, is Google. Their finance page is pretty bad. And they even, I think when they first, started Google, they said, we will never really have a good finance page. And they weren't lying. Check it out. It's not that great. So if you find something you like, please contact me. In the chat, it's not there yet, but it will be. In the Chapter 5 will be a quick presentation on how to do the research that you need to do for Chapter 5 for your assignment using Yahoo. But you don't have to use Yahoo. You could use Bloomberg. You can use MarketWatch, Morningstar, CNBC. Play. A friend of mine uses this one company called Big Charts. And I thought it was really bad, but I didn't. Tell them that. I just thought, this is really horrible. Slide 47. All right. Finally, dear students, we've gotten to the point where we're going to take a look at these market indices, these market averages, in detail, even though we've been dancing around them since the beginning of the semester. How can we say to people, hey, stocks have returned approximately 10% over the past 70, 80 years or so, or, 5% over the last 10 years, however we say it. How can we tell people, oh, yeah, stocks should return the 8, 9, 10%? Well, the industry uses what are called market averages, market indexes. They are benchmarks, which is a fancy way of saying something we use to measure. They are benchmarks used to measure the general behavior of securities prices by reflecting either the average price behavior, that's a market average, or relational price behavior, that's a market index, of representative groups of securities at any given point in time. Huh? They're just looking at a list of stocks, or bonds, or whatever, and saying, okay, as a group, this is what they did. Because some are going to do well, some are going to do poorly, and the rest are going to just basically follow the rest of the herd. And you can't help but hear about these every single day in the news. The Dow went up! The Nasdaq went down! What are they talking about? I am not going to hold you to the difference between a market average and a market index. The book goes into great detail about them. Don't worry about it, because most people don't even know that there's a difference between an average and an index. They just look at the numbers, and that's what you're going to do. But if you're so inclined, if you really want to be a stickler for this, do look at the differences between a market average and market index. I am not going to hold you to it. Slide 48. Market averages use a share price calculation, looks solely at the price of the stock without regard to the market value. The market indexes use a market weighted calculation. They look at the stock price times the number of shares outstanding, and we will discuss that in detail when we get to market capitalization. This takes into account the market value of the stock in the index. The larger the market share, the more influence the security will have in the index. So you've heard of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. You can't help but hear, but you don't even know it's called the Dow Jones Industrial Average. You just heard it was called the Dow. That's an average. The Standard & Poor's 500 stock index that we've been discussing quite a bit in chapters 1 and then again a lot in chapter 4 is an index. And that takes into account the size of the company in the index. And market-weighted calculations were generally regarded as a better measure of securities until the bubble of the late 1990s, when it drove a few of the largest companies to outrageous amounts, and many of the smaller companies in the Standard & Poor's 500 index were just left in the dust. And so it got skewed, as we discussed in Chapter 4, and we'll discuss again much later on after we're done everything. Figure that one out. So again, am I going to hold you to the difference between a market average and a market index? No. You just need to know the popular ones and what they are, and we'll discuss these starting now. Slide 49. The most popular, the most venerable, the one that they always start all the news with is the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Most people don't even know that it's called the Dow Jones Industrial Average. They just call it the Dow Average, the DJIA. This is a market average that is made up of 30, so they say, high-quality stocks selected for total market value and broad public ownership and believed to reflect overall market activity. They are lying. It turns out that even though this is the most famous of the stock market measures, it's pretty much bad. It's gotten really, really horrible. And they should just drive a stake in its heart and get rid of it, but I don't think that's going to happen because it's in every news report, on the television, radio, internet. What happens is this thing changes from time to time as companies and industries evolve. And as such, it now has more non-industrial stocks than industrial stocks. So why do they still call it the Dow Jones Industrial Average? I don't know. Dow Jones is the company that publishes the Wall Street Journal. And for decades, it was a closely held family business. In 2007, even though it wasn't for sale, Rupert Murdoch of Fox News fame, his company's called News Corp, and he's Fox News guy. He's actually from Australia, although if you don't believe what Fox News says, then you're not a good American, but he's Australian. But anyway, he wanted the Dow Jones company. He wanted the Wall Street Journal. And he offered them $5 billion. Now, even though it's a private company, it had generally been priced at was worth about $3 billion. He paid $5 billion for it because he wanted it. And the family, at first, some of the family said, "We're not selling it to this guy. He's the guy who has the New York Post and the muckraking star, or whatever it's called, in the News of the World." That was it. The News of the World in the UK that got put out of business because they were stealing people's cell phones. They were stealing people's messages off their cell phones, which is illegal, by the way. And they said, "We're not selling it to him." And the others said, "What are you talking about? He's offering us $5 billion. Let's sell it." And he got it. It's in his feather in his cap or whatever. But it's very interesting. Almost within a year or so after he bought it, he started making noises like, "Well, we don't really want the Dow Jones average anymore." And I thought, well, this is interesting. What is he going to do with it? And it just turns out, it's taken a few years, but it turns out it looks like, I can't really tell from the press releases, they act like it's a partnership, but it looks like Standard & Poor's is taking it over. So if you can figure it out, please tell me. But if you look at the press releases, they're acting like the Wall Street Journal is still involved in it, but at the same time they're saying that Standard & Poor's is running the show. So if you can figure it out, please tell me. Here they are. Whoops! I pressed the wrong button. My apologies. It's going to slide. It's going to go flying off of you, and you're going to say, "What are you doing, Piano?" My apologies. Here they are, folks. Slide number 50. I hit the wrong button. My apologies. There they are, slide 50. The 30 stocks in the Dow Jones Industrial Average as of the 2014 February. And most of these companies you've heard of, right? You know pretty much all of them. American Express, AT&T, Boeing, big planes, right? Jet planes. Caterpillar, earth moving equipment, diesels, Chevron, oil company, Cisco. What do they make? Cisco. They make internet equipment. Coca-Cola, Disney, DuPont is a chemical company. ExxonMobil, energy. General Electric, they've been in the Dow since the beginning, 1896. They're the only one. Goldman Sachs, what kind of industrial company is that? Yeah, they were just put into the Dow Jones just last year. Home Depot, IBM, Intel, Johnson & Johnson, J.P. Morgan Chase, McDonald's, Merck, that's a drug company. Microsoft, Nike, they make footwear. They were just put into the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Pfizer is a drug company. Procter & Gamble, who are they? Yeah, a good company to research. 3M is the company that makes Scotch tape and Post-it notes. Travelers is an insurance company. United Healthcare is an insurance company. United Technologies. Now, there's an industrial. That's like GE. They make industrial equipment. They make Otis elevators and Pratt & Whitney jet engines. Verizon's a telephone like AT&T. Visa and Walmart. So are these companies industrial companies? No, they're not. Some of them are, just only a few, but most of them are not anything other than industrial companies. McDonald's is an industrial hamburgers, I don't know. But what's the problem with the Dow Jones Industrial Average? It's only 30 companies. And 50 years ago, when things changed much more slowly, they would, get rid of a company, put in another company, but for the most part, it wasn't changing that fast. In the last 20 years, they've been pulling out companies, putting back in companies left and right. They put in Microsoft, took out Union Carbide, a chemical company, in 1999, a year before the internet bubble burst. And Microsoft has never gotten back to the point it was in 1999. They waited until GM and American International Group, another insurance company, were virtually in bankruptcy before they took them out. And Bank of America almost went under. So you see, it's 30 companies. It's not enough. And so when you hear people say, "Well, the Dow is basically where it was back in 2003, whatever," don't believe them, because it's not the same. It changes, and it's changing so fast. They're moving companies in and out that it's almost basically a useless measure. And this is nothing new. Two decades ago, Warren Buffett basically said, "Would you just ignore the market indices and worry about investing in companies, the market averages and the like?" He just said, "Ignore them," because of this survivorship bias and them putting in a company at the height of its doing well, such as AIG and Microsoft, and then taking them out as they're falling into the porcelain oasis. Kodak used to be in the Dow. So, yeah, I know. What are you going to do, right? And I wasn't there yet, but it'll be there soon. There will be a document called 80 Years, right? How have you done over 80 years? And I'll ask you to take a look at that when it's available. It's not there yet. The data for 2013 is not available yet. So let's continue. Slide number 51. Here are some examples of how the Dow has done over years. From 1906 to 1924, it started at 100 and then got back to 100 in 1924. In the meantime, it had crashed and burned and then came back up. So it basically did nothing, is what people will say, right? But even though, remember, it's changing. 1924, 1929, it went up three times. The Roaring Twenties. And the subsequent crash of 1929, where it went from 300 down to, what, 40 or 39? And then it took until 1954, 25 years, for it to get back to 300. Between 54 and 66, it went up another three times, only to then go back down, back up to 1,000, back down, back up to 1,000 in 1982. 16 years. And then from 1982 look at what happened. 1982 to 2000. That was the great run-up. Yes. 11 times. And then from 2000 to 2011, it went from 11,000 down, and then back up again, and down, and back up again. So, folks, how do you make money in stocks during times when the markets and capital gains are flat? Huh? How do you do that? Well, the answer depends upon whether you are an investor or a speculator or a trader. The speculator, the trader would say you need to tactically get in and out of stocks. You need to buy low, sell high, buy low, sell high, buy and sell, and that's how you make money. Yeah. Good luck. The investor would say we need to think long term. We need to invest in companies for the long term and buy as we have our resources, invest wisely, and just hold on to them for the long term. And when things are going well, be very happy. When things are not so going well, relax and know that if the whole thing falls apart, it really doesn't matter. Yeah, it doesn't matter where you have your money. You know, we'll all be digging for beetle grubs. Slide, and don't forget dividends. Yeah, dividends. Yeah, dividends are cool. So slide 52. Dow Jones has other averages and indexes. The Dow Transport Average. Some people use the Transport Average as a proxy for how well the market and the economy are going to do in the future. Because before things can be sold, they've got to get to where they are to be made, and then they have to get to where they're sold. So the utilities average, obviously, that's for people who like utilities that aren't going anywhere. And then if you add the industrial, the transportation, the utilities, you get the Dow Jones 65 stocks composite average. Now, the next one is actually very interesting and one that you may have seen something about in Chapter 4, because it's called the Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index. Well, what a dumb name. Well, it originally was called the Wilshire 5000. And Wilshire is a company based in L.A., Wilshire, you know, Wilshire Boulevard. And they said, let's create an index that contains the big companies, the Standard & Poor's 500, the medium-sized companies, and small companies. So we'll call it the Wilshire 5000. Well, Dow Jones kind of took over Wilshire, and they called it the Dow Jones Wilshire 5000 Total Stock Market Index, Total Market Index. And then they kicked Wilshire to the side, and now they call it the Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index. And Wilshire created the Wilshire 4500 originally, and now, of course, they've been kicked to the side. And the Wilshire 4500 is the Wilshire 5000 minus the 500 stocks in the S&P 500, which are the 500 largest companies in the United States. So the Wilshire 4500 is a way to measure how the medium-sized and small companies are doing. And when you researched the thrift savings plan, you might have noticed that the S fund uses the Wilshire 4500. Well, it's not called the Wilshire 4500 anymore. It's now called the Dow Jones U.S. Completion Total Stock Market Index. Who comes up with these names? That's a dumb name. Some people call it the extended or the completion, whatever. But that's the idea, right? How are the medium-sized and small companies doing? Forget the 500 largest companies in the S&P 500. And then the Dow Jones Internet Index was just a wonderful example of how the Brave New World isn't always brave, and sometimes it's not new. It's just the same old thing over again. We're going to crash and burn. The Dow Jones Internet Index was created in the late 1990s, when the Internet was raging, and proceeded to lose 97% of its value. Yeah. Talk about bad timing. Slide number 53. Here it is, folks. The S&P 500. This is what the Dow, this is what should replace the Dow. The Dow really should, someone should just bury it. And just, but that, it's not going to happen. The Dow is so popular. The Standard & Poor's 500 is the index that shows you how the big companies are doing. The S&P is the company that is owned by McGraw-Hill, the same company that produced your book. They own television stations, radio stations. They make magazines and textbooks. They make a lot of money off the textbooks. Can you, you know why, because you're paying the money. And they own Standard & Poor's, a rating agency, an agency that does research. And the Standard & Poor's 500 Composite Index is the list of 500 stocks chosen for market size, liquidity, and industry group representation. And traditionally, it contained the largest 500 companies based in the United States. But it now can contain foreign stocks. Well, why is that? Because some foreign international companies have purchased very large United States companies. For example, Daimler-Benz, or Mercedes-Benz, you know it as, purchased in 1997, Chrysler. And so S&P said, what do we do? Well, Chrysler is a very big company in the United States. Let's let Daimler-Benz into the S&P 500. BP, British Petroleum, bought Amoco and Arco. So what do you do, right? Exactly. So now a few of them are foreign. It's a very popular index. Why? Because of those index mutual funds. And you've already seen how popular they are. Because the S&P 500 is market-weighted, it was affected by the tech bubble of the late 1990s in a bizarre manner. The market values of a small percentage of tech companies were inflated to outrageous extremes. For a while there, Microsoft was worth $500 billion. Cisco was worth $500 billion for a while. I think Oracle didn't quite make it, but this skewed the index even more toward those companies. And because those companies represent a larger portion of the index funds have to go out and buy more shares. So you see, it's a feedback mechanism. It's a feedback loop. The company gets larger, so the index funds have to buy more shares, which raises the price, which makes the company larger. And yes, that's why we saw the tech bubble burst, and the S&P 500 go on to lose 50% almost between March of 2000 to October of 2002. But the NASDAQ, which represents the tech sector, losing 80%. And in 1998, 10% of the gain in the Standard & Poor's 500 was due to one stock. That was Microsoft. Now, wait a minute. This is supposed to be a list of 500 companies, and one company is responsible for 10% of the gain? So you see, anybody who tries to tell you that indexed investing is perfect and is the fail-safe way, tell them, no, there is no perfect way. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. I'm not saying that it has good advantages. It does have good advantages. But there are always disadvantages. And, dear students, you need to have your eyes open when you invest. Slide number 54. And S&P has just dozens and dozens of other indices. The Industrial 400, the Mid-Cap 400, or the medium-sized companies, the Small-Cap 600, small companies, and then you throw those all together, the 500, the 400, and the 600, and you get the Standard & Poor's 1500 index, which is supposed to show you how the market as a whole is doing, but the Wilshire 5000 is more popular. Now the U.S., Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index. And then Standard & Poor's has transportation, utilities, financials, global, international, sector indices. Go on their website, Standard & Poor's, and you'll see dozens and dozens. And you'll also see the press releases for their, merger, their consortium, their association, they're taking over of the Dow Jones indices. Now, the New York Stock Exchange has its own composite index. You might see it advertised, probably won't. The Amex, now the New York Stock Exchange MICET, I think it's not called, I think it's MKT, I don't know what it's called. I mean, I know what they write, but I don't know how it's pronounced. But they have their own index. And then the NASDAQ, oh boy, the NASDAQ is important. Because the NASDAQ is the place where most of the technology companies are. There are other companies there, folks. I mean, Starbucks, is that a technology company? Costco? But you'll hear people call the NASDAQ composite index the tech index. And what happened? Well, from 800, it went from 800 in 1995 to 5,000 in 2000. This was when, right, the blue skies, productivity, you're going to order your fruits and vegetables, your groceries over the internet, never step into a store again. It then went on to drop from 5,000 to 1,200 in 2.5 years before starting to recover in 2003. It's now over 4,000, and people saying, when is it going to get to 5,000? Well, it's never going to get to 5,000. Well, yes, it will, but it's not the same index. Those companies that brought it up to 5,000, most of them are gone. AOL, I mean, it's still around, but it's a shell of what it used to be. CMGI, right? CMGI, you don't even know what it is, but it was a huge internet company. eToys, right? Pets.com, DrCoop.com, all these dot-com books, The Street, The Globe, these companies that were huge. Some of them survived, eBay, Amazon, but most of those companies are gone. And the telecommunication companies that disappeared, such as Windstar, and WorldCom. Yeah, right. So when the NASDAQ does get back to 5,000, people will be jumping up and down and saying, hey, the NASDAQ down the back to 5,000. It's not the same index. It's see how people rely on these things, and they're just not what people think they are. Okay, enough. Now, some other popular ones on slide 56. The total stock market index. Well, we've already discussed these. The Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index used to be called the Wilshire 5000. Standard & Poor's has their own Total Stock Market Index. And MSCI, which we'll see in just a bit, they have their U.S. Broad Market Index. The Completion Stock Market Indices used to be called the Wilshire 4500, the one that was used for the TSP, Thrift Savings Plan, S Fund, Dow Jones U.S. Completions Total Stock Market. Why don't they just call it the Wilshire 4500? No. And then S&P and MSCI, they have their own completion indexes. So make sure those two you do know, though. I remember them as Wilshire 5000 and Wilshire 4500. And then slide 57, the Russell 2000. Now, this, folks, is the index that people will look at when they want to measure small company performance. As we saw, there are others from Standard & Poor's and all the other people, but this one is the most popular. This is the one you'll hear people discuss when they're talking about small companies. Russell, it's called Frank Russell Associates, and what they did is they took the top 3,000 companies, called the Russell 3000, they took the top 1,000 companies in terms of size, they call out the Russell 1000, and they kick out the top 1,000 companies out of the top 3,000, and they're left with the 1,001th, the 1,001st company down to the 3,000th company, and that's called the Russell 2000. And that's what people, and sometimes in the news you'll hear them talk about, yeah, the Russell's doing really well, small companies and mid-sized companies are doing really well. And then what about foreign and global companies? Well, for decades, the two indices that were used were the MSCI World Index and the MSCI EAFE. Now, most people have no idea what MSCI stands for. It stands for Morgan Stanley Capital International. You do not have to remember that. But there's a interesting history that goes along with that. American Funds is one of the mutual funds that we looked at in Chapter 4. They're one of the largest companies. They're the third largest company. And they were one of, even though they're called American, they're really run by a company called the Capital Group. Capital. And Capital was one of the first companies, not the only one, but they were one of the first companies to invest outside the United States. But they didn't have very good measurements for the outside, the foreign, the global markets. So they created their own indices. But that doesn't, you know, you see what the problem is? Here they are creating an index and then measuring themselves against the index. It doesn't bode well. It doesn't look good, right? So what they did is they sold them off to Morgan Stanley. And then Morgan Stanley kept the name Capital International, so they're called Morgan Stanley Capital International. And for decades, the two were the world, which was meant to show global, you know, everybody, including the United States, and then the EAFE, that's how it's pronounced, even though it looks like it should be EAFE or whatever, E-A-F-E. EAFE stood for, still does, Europe, Australia, and the Far East. And that was everybody but the United States. But the problem with these indices is that they measured the developed world. They looked at United States, Canada, Western Europe, Japan, Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore, and they ignored the developing countries. Well, instead of just updating the World Index and the EAFE Index, what MSCI has done is created two new indices. The MSCI All Country World Index and the MSCI All Country World ex-USA Index. Ooh, I don't know who comes up with these names, folks. But that's what's happening. They're being replaced. The World Index and the EAFE Index are being replaced by the All Country World and the All Country World ex-USA. Are you confused yet? Are you bothered by all the ones? Look, on worksheet number one, you will see the indexes that you should know by name. And let me see if I can remember all of them. The Dow, the Standard & Poor's 500, the NASDAQ, the World and the EAFE being replaced by the All Country World and the All Country World ex-USA, the Russell 2000, and the, I said the NASDAQ, didn't I? Okay, so those are the ones we want you to know. So check out stock worksheet number one. There's an answer key, there's a commentary. Those are the ones we want you to know by name. Oh, yeah, the Wilshire 4500. We want you to know the Wilshire 5000, Wilshire 4500. Yeah, so I think I said those. I don't remember. But go look at stock worksheet number one. Okay? All right. Now, this in the face-to-face class, we would now do it together in face-to-face, but we're not in the face-to-face class. Slide number 58. Part of these things are also used to sell newspapers and advertising on the Internet and television and radio, because this is what you're going to see every day in the news. Oh, my goodness, look at today's unstable stock market. The Dow started at 15,670 and rocketed up to 680, but by the afternoon had fallen, plummeted to 15,655, only to basically go back up where it started at the beginning of the day. This is the graph you're going to see. But what are they doing, dear students? Well, there's a wonderful book. It's written back in the 50s, so the numbers are all wrong, but it's called How to Lie with Statistics. And one of the first things they teach you how to do is show a bar chart where all they show is a little bitty part of the numbers. They don't show you the whole graph. Why? Because if they showed you the whole graph, the mania, the stock market index mania, would change to stock market index ennui. You like that word? Ennui. It's a French word. It means, well, it's English now, but originally from French. It means beyond boredom. See, if they showed you the whole graph from 0 to 16,000, would they sell any newspapers? Would they sell any Internet advertising or television or radio advertising? No. No. So they're not going to show you that graph, right? And so now we can come back. Remember the volatility graph we saw in the first presentation? If we had showed you the whole graph, you would find that this is the volatility for the Standard & Poor's 500 for the year 2013. This is the boring version. Folks, you will not see this graph in the news, okay? Trust me on that. I know you will not see this graph because it wouldn't sell advertising. It wouldn't make you worried and fret and run to your broker and sell your stocks. Okay, now I want you to go back. Yes, go back. You need to know the different transactions, odd lots and round lots, and then all the different mark, not all of them, but just the ones in the worksheet, the market indices. Okay? And when we come back, we will continue our discussion of stocks. Are you excited? I hope so. This is very, very interesting to me. Of course, duh, I teach it. But I always find it incredibly exciting because the world is never stops changing. And oh boy, is it changing quickly now. See you in our next presentation.